All right, last we left off with Kintsugi's kingdom, we were talking about Michael not having enough, having everything change. And so he just met his dad at the South Beach, Southampton. And so dad's telling them to come, pack, we're right on the sea. And mom's just thinking, okay, well, something's very different. So I'm going to pick up where we left off in class, then I'll keep reading, and then I might say a few things here or there just to kind of get you to be thinking, and we'll read my time to be able to do this first podcast would only be 90 minutes, so we'll have a little time here to be able to read. And so I'll start where you've heard some of it just to kind of get us back. Sometimes when you watch movies, you have to rewind, and that's kind of the same thing with books. My father did indeed seem a changed man. He was waiting for us when we got off the train, all bright-eyed and full of laughter. He helped us with the suitcases. "It's not far," he said, ruffling my hair. "You will wait till you see it, monkey face. I've got it all worked out, the whole thing, and it's no good you trying to talk me out of it either of you. I've made up my mind." "About what?" I asked him. "You'll see," he said. Stella Artois bounded along ahead of us, her tail held high and happy. We all felt like that, I think, happy. In the end, we caught a bus because the suitcases were too heavy. When we got off, we were right by the sea. There didn't seem to be any houses anywhere, just a yachting marina. "What are we doing here?" my mother asked. "There's someone I want you to meet, a good friend of mine. She's called Peggy Sue. She's been looking forward to meeting you. I've told her all about you." My mother frowned at me in puzzlement. I wasn't any the wiser either. All I knew for certain was that he was being deliberately mysterious. We struggled on with our suitcases, the gulls crying overhead, the yacht masts clapping around us, and Stella yapping at all of it. Until at last, he stopped right by a gangplank that led up to a gleaming dark blue yacht. He put the suitcases down, turned to us. He was grinning from ear to ear. "Here she is," he said. "Let me introduce you. This is the Peggy Sue, our new home." "Well?" Now, considering everything, my mom took it pretty well. She didn't shout at him. She just went very quiet. And she stayed quiet all through his explanation down to the galley over a cup of tea. Now, in your head, you guys should be thinking, Dad just sold everything and they're going to live on a boat. And so now he's going to try and convince them, here's the Peggy Sue and this is where I think we need to be. This is going to be our new home. She was just very quiet and stayed quiet all through his explanation down in the galley over a cup of tea. It wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing, you know. I've been thinking about it a long time, all those years working in the factory. All right, well, maybe I was just dreaming about it in those days. Funny when you think about it. If I hadn't lost my job, I'd never have dared to do it. Not in a million years. He knew he wasn't making much sense. All right. All right, then. Here's what I thought. What is it that we all love doing most? Sailing, right? Wouldn't it be wonderful, I thought, if we could just take off and sail around the world? There's people who've done it. Blue water sailing, they call it. I've read about it in the magazines. Like I said, it was just a dream to start with. And then no job and no chance of a job. So why not a boat? We've got our severance pay, which is the pay they give them. They'll lose their job, but they get paid so many months after, and they get some of their benefits and just to kind of get them by till they can find another job. We've got our severance pay. We've got our severance pay, what little there was of it. There's a bit saved up in the car money. Not a fortune, but enough. What to do with it? I could put it all in the bank like the others did. But what for? Just to let it dribble away till there was nothing left? Or I thought I could do something really special with it. a once-in-a-lifetime thing. We could sail around the world, Africa, South America, Australia, the Pacific. We could see places we've only ever dreamed of. We sat there completely dumbstruck. Oh, I know what you're thinking, he went on. You're thinking, all we've ever done is reservoir sailing, dinghy sailing. You're thinking, he's gone crazy. Loopy in the head. You're thinking, it's dangerous. You're thinking, we'll be flat broke. But I've thought it all out. I even thought of your grandma. There's a thing. We won't be gone forever, will we? She'll be here when we get back, won't she? She's perfectly healthy. We've got the money. I've done my math. We'll be gone. We'll be going to do 6 months of training. We'll be away a year, 18 months maybe, just so long as the money lasts. We're going to do it safe. Do it properly. Mom, you'll get your yacht master's certificate. Oh, didn't I say? I didn't, did I? You'll be the skipper, Mom. I'll be the first mate and handyman. Michael, you'll be the ship's boy. And Stella, well, Stella can be the ship's cat. He was full into it, breathless with excitement. Now, think to yourself, why would they have a cat on a boat? And I want you to just think about, you know, many times what would happen on the boats is that they'd have all of the food and all of the storage there. And if you know anything about like pirate ships or anything, any kind of ships that are out in the sea, they sometimes tend to attract these little critters called rats. And so many ships would have a ship's cat. And I bet you can think of what they'd use that cat for. We'll get ourselves in shape. Do a few trips across the channel to France, maybe over to Ireland. We'll get to know this boat like she's one of us. She's a 42-foot Bowman. Best make, best design, safest there is. I've done my homework. 6 months' time, we'll be off around the world. It'll be the adventure of a lifetime. Our one chance. We'll never get another one. What do you think then? Excellent, I breathe. And that was exactly what I thought. And I'll be the skipper, you say? My mother asked. Aye, aye, Captain, my father said, and he laughed and gave her a mock salute. And what about Michael's school? She went on. I've thought of that too. I asked in the local school down here. It's all arranged. We'll take all the books we'll need. I'll teach him. You'll teach him. He'll teach himself. I'll tell you something for nothing. He'll learn more in a couple of years at sea than he ever would in that monkey school of his. Promise. She took a sip of tea and then nodded slowly. All right, she said. And I saw she was smiling. Why not? Go ahead then. Buy the boat. Well, I already have, said my father. Of course, it was madness. And they knew it. Even I knew it, but it simply didn't matter. Thinking back, it must have been a kind of inspiration driven by desperation. Everyone warned us against it. Grandma came visiting and stayed on board. It was all quite ridiculous, she said. Reckless, irresponsible. She was full of gloom and doom. Icebergs, hurricanes, pirates, whales, super tankers, freak waves. She heaped up horror upon horror, thinking to frighten me so as to frighten off my mother and father. She succeeded in terrifying me, all right, but I never showed it. What she didn't understand was that we three were already bound together by some common lunacy. We were going, and nothing and no one could stop us. We were doing what people do in fairy tales. We were going off to seek adventure. To begin with, it all happened with much as my father had planned it, except that the training took a little longer. We soon learned that handling a 42-foot yacht was not just dinghy sailing in a bigger boat. We were tutored by a whiskered old mariner from the yacht club, Bill Barker. Barnacle Bill, we called him, but not to his face, of course. He had been twice around Cape Horn and had made two single-handed Atlantic crossings, and he'd been across the channel more times than you'd have had a hot dinners, my lad, he said. To tell the truth, none of us liked him much. He was a hard taskmaster. He treated me and Stella Artois with equal disdain. In other words, he didn't want them around. To him, all animals and children were just a nuisance, and on board ship, nothing but a liability. In other words, they were nothing but something to cause trouble. And so I kept out of his way as much as I could, and so did Stella Artois. And to be fair to him, Barnacle Bill did know his business. And by the time he had finished with us and my mother was given her certificate, we felt we could sail the Peggy Sue anywhere. He had inculcated in us a healthy respect for the sea, but at the same time, we were confident we could handle just about anything the sea could hurl at us. Mind you, there were times I was scared stiff. My father and I shared our terror together, silently. You can't pretend, I learned, with a towering green wall of water 20 feet high bearing down on you. We went down in troughs so deep we never thought we could possibly climb out again. But we did, and the more we rode our terror, rode the waves, the more we felt ourselves and of the boat around us. The more we felt sure of ourselves and the boat around us. My mother, though, never showed even the faintest tremor of terror. She and the Peggy Sue saw us through our worst moments, but she was seasick from time to time, and we never were. So that was something. We lived close, all of us, cheek by jowl, and I soon discovered my parents were more than just parents. My father became my friend, my shipmate. We came to rely on each other. And as for my mother, the truth is, and I admit it, I didn't know she had it in her. I had always known she was gritty and that she'd keep on at a thing until she'd done it. But she worked night and day over her books and charts until she had mastered everything. She never stopped. True, she could be a bit of a tyrant if you didn't keep the boat ship shape. But neither my father nor I minded that much, though we pretended to. She was the skipper. She was going to take us around the world and back again. We had absolute confidence in her. We were proud of her. She was just brilliant. And I have to say, the ship's boy and the first mate were, pretty brilliant too, on the winches, at the helm, and with the baked beans in the galley. We were a great team. And so, on September 10th, 1987, I know the date because I have the ship's logs in front of me as I write, with every nook and cranny loaded with stores and provisions, we were at last ready to set sail on our grand adventure, our great odyssey. Grandma was there to wave us off tearfully. In the end, she even wanted to come with us to visit Australia. She'd always wanted to see koalas in the wild. There were lots of our friends there too, including Barnacle Bill. Eddie Dodds came, along with his father. He threw me a soccer ball as we cast off. "Lucky mascot," he shouted. And when I looked down at it later, I saw he'd signed his name all over it like a World Cup star. Stella Artois barked her farewells at them and at every boat we passed in the Solent. But as we were sailing out past the Isle of Wight, she fell strangely quiet. Maybe she sensed, as we did, that there was no turning back now. This was not a dream. We were off around the world. It was real, really real. Next chapter is called Water, Water Everywhere. They say that water covers 2/3 of the Earth's surface. It certainly looks like that when you're out there, and it feels like it too. Seawater, rainwater, all of it is wet. I spent most of the time soaked to the bone. I wore all the right gear. The skipper always made sure of that. But somehow the wet still got through. Down below, too, everything was damp, even the sleeping bags. Only when the sun shone and the sea had stopped its heaving could we begin to dry out. We would haul everything on deck, and soon the Peggy Sue would be all dressed up, one great clothesline from bow to stern. This means from the front to the back. To be dry again was a real luxury, but we always knew we could not last for long. You may think there was a lot for three people, there was not a lot for three people to do on board day after day, week after week. You'd be quite wrong. In the daylight, there was never a dull moment. I was always kept busy, taking in sail, winching in, letting out, taking my turn at the wheel, which I loved, or helping my father with his endless mending and fixing. He often needed a pair of hands to hold steady as he drilled or hammered or screwed or sawed something on the boat. I'd forever be mopping up, brewing up, washing up, drying up. I'd be lying if I said I loved it all. I didn't. But there was never a dull moment. Only one of the crew was allowed to be idle, Stella Artois, and she was always idle. In other words, she didn't do much. With nothing much to bark at out on this open ocean, she spent the rougher days curled up on my bed down in the cabin. When it was fine and calm, though, she'd usually be found on watch up at the bow, alert for something, anything that wasn't just water. You could be sure that if there was anything out there, she'd spot it soon enough. An escort of porpoises, perhaps, diving in and out of the waves. A family of dolphins swimming alongside, so close that you could reach out and touch them. Whales, sharks, even turtles. We saw them all. My mother would be taking photographs, video, and still, while my father and I fought over the binoculars. But Stella Artois was in her element, a proper sheepdog again, barking her commands at the creatures of the sea, herding them up from the deep. Annoying though she could be, she would bring her smelly wetness with her everywhere. We never once regretted bringing her along with us. She was our greatest comfort. When the sea tossed and churned us, and my mother felt like death from seasickness, she'd sit down below, white to the gills, with Stella on her lap, cuddling and being cuddled. And when I was terrified by the mountainous seas and the screaming wild wind, I would curl up with Stella on my bunk, bury my head in her neck, and hold her tight. At times like that, and I don't suppose they were that frequent, it's just that I remember them so vividly, I always kept Eddie's soccer ball close beside me as well. The soccer ball had become a sort of talisman for me, you know, a lucky charm. And it really seemed to work, too. After all, every storm did blow itself out in the end, and afterward, we were always still there, still alive, and still floating. I had hoped my mother and father might forget all about the planned schoolwork, and to begin with, it seemed as if they had. But once we had weathered a few storms, and once we had settled and well into our voyage, they sat me down and told me the unwelcome news. Like it or not, I was going to have to keep up with my schoolwork. My mother was adamant about it. I could see that any appeals to my father would be pointless. He just shrugged and said, "Mom's the skipper." And that was the end of the matter. At least at home, she had been my mother, and I could argue with her sometimes a little bit, but not on the Peggy Sue. Not anymore. It was a conspiracy. Between them, they had devised an entire program of work. There were math books to get through. My father would help me with that if I got stuck, he said. For geography and history, I was to find out and record all I could about every country we visited as we went around the world. I wouldn't mind that. For environmental studies and art, I was to note down and draw all the birds we saw, all the creatures and plants we came across. My mother made a particular point of teaching me navigation, too. "Barnacle Bill taught me," she said, "and I'm teaching you. I know it's not on the curriculum, but so what? It could come in handy. You never know." She taught me how to use the sextant. And that's like, if you've seen pictures, it's like a navigation system on there. It's on a ship, and it's got the compass that's in it, but then it also has this map part that goes along with it as well. Taking compass bearings, plotting a course on the chart. I had to fill in the longitude and latitude in the ship's log every morning, every evening, without fail. I don't think I had ever really noticed stars before. Now, whenever I was on watch in the cockpit at night with the Peggy Sue on her wind vane self-steering, the others asleep below, the stars would be my only company. So when his parents were sleeping below, he would be in charge of the ship. And he'd be the only one up there with Stella. Gazing up at them, I felt sometimes that they were that we were the last people alive on the whole planet. There was just us and the dark sea around us and the millions and millions of stars above. It was on watch at night that I would often do my English homework, so to speak. This was my own version of the ship's log. I didn't have to show it to them, but I was encouraged to write in it every few weeks. It would be, they said, my own personal private record of our voyage. At school, I had never been much good at writing. I could never think of what to write or how to begin. But on the Peggy Sue, I found I could open up on my log and just write. And there was always so much I wanted to say. And that's the thing. I found I didn't really write it down at all. Rather, I just said it. I spoke it from my head, down my arm, through my fingers, and my pencil, and onto the page. It's one of my favorite lines. And that's how it reads to me now, all these years later, like me talking. I'm looking at my log now. The paper is a bit crinkled, and the pages are yellowed with age. My scribbly writing is a little faded, but it's mostly quite legible. What follows are just a few chosen excerpts from this log. The entries are quite short, but they tell the tale. And this is how I recorded our great journey. This is how it was for an 11-year-old boy as he rode the wild, wide oceans of the world aboard the Peggy Sue. And so the next chapter is called Ship's Log, and it has a lot of different entries in there. But remember when I talked about authors talk about in the first few chapters, they give you a lot of information. So in these first two chapters, you know that this is an adventure that they've chosen, and they chose it because they lost their jobs and they felt like this was going to change things. This is going to be something they would never be able to do or think about if they had had their jobs. And so they're looking at this as an opportunity. And so they made sure they were trained and ready to go. A couple of things you need to know too in thinking about this is that Michael is learning how to navigate the boat as well. And so he has some responsibilities on the ship. And he puts together the ship's log as far as he puts the navigation in the morning and in the afternoon. So they're using maps to be able to do that. The latitude and longitude markings that he needs to put in there. And so when you look back on anyone's ship's logs, like you can even find Christopher Columbus's ship logs, they used these instruments on the ship to be able to help them, and they would record the latitude and longitude. And so you can retrace someone's steps. In fact, that was how people found out that Christopher Columbus, later on, as they were looking at his adventure and his ship's logs, they found out that he didn't really land in America at first. He landed on an island off of America near the Bahamas called San Salvador. And so even though he thought he was in America, he really wasn't. The very first person that arrived here as a sailor, as a explorer, was Amerigo Vespucci. And if you think of his first name and think of America, his name was Amerigo. And from his ship's logs, you can tell his trip and how he got to this area. So in the book here, we're going to be reading about the ship's log. And we're going to be reading about some of the things that he wrote in here, things that are happening and things that they did along the way. And the reason why the author is telling you this is because the ship's log all of a sudden stops. And we'll read this and we'll get to the last part of this chapter. And then that'll be the first three chapters. And remember, I told you that in chapter books, the first three chapters, about the third chapter is when the action starts to pick up. All right, here we go. Ship's log, September 20th. It's 5 in the morning. I'm on watch in the cockpit and no one else is awake. We left Southampton 10 days ago now. The channel was full of tankers. There were dozens of them. So either mom or dad took turns on watch the first 2 nights. They wouldn't let me. I don't know why not. There wasn't any fog and I can see as well as they can. They were planning on sailing about 200 miles a day. That's about 8 knots. But in the first week, we were lucky if we made 50 miles a day. Barnacle Bill warned us about the Bay of Biscay. So we were getting to the bad. So we were expecting it to be bad, sorry. And it was. Force 9 gale. Force 10 sometimes. We were slammed all over the place. I thought we'd sink. I really did. Once, when we came to the top of a wave, I saw the bow of the Peggy Sue pointing straight up at the moon. So they're going up the wave and they're actually, the whole front of the ship is pointing up toward the sky. It was like she was going to take off. Then we were hurled down the other side so fast I was sure we were going to the bottom. It was bad. I mean, it was horrible, really horrible. But the Peggy Sue didn't fall apart and we made it to Spain. Mom gets quite snappy with us sometimes when we don't do things right. Dad doesn't seem to mind, not out here, not at sea. He just winks at me and we forget about it. They play a lot of chess together when it's calm enough. Dad's winning so far, 5-3. Mom says it doesn't bother her, but it does. I can tell. We only spent a couple of days in La Coruna. Mom slept a lot. She was really tired. Dad did some work on the rudder cable while we were there. He's still not happy with it, though. We set off for the Orzos 2 days ago. Yesterday was the best day we've had for sailing. Strong breeze, blue sky, and warm sun to dry things out. My blue shorts blew off the clothesline into the sea. It doesn't matter. I never really liked them much anyway. We saw gannets slicing into the sea all around us this afternoon. Really excellent. Stella Artois went crazy. I'm sick of baked beans already, though. And there's still stacks and stacks of them down below. October 11th. Today I saw Africa. It was in the distance, but Mom said it was definitely Africa. We're going down the west coast. Mom showed me on this chart. The wind will take us down the coast for a few hundred miles and then across the Atlantic to South America. We mustn't drift off course or else we'll get into the doldrums. There's no wind there at all, and we could sit there, be calmed for weeks, maybe forever. It's the hottest day we've had. Dad's very red in the face and the tops of his ears are peeling. I'm more like a nutty brown, like my mom. Saw flying fish early this morning, and so did Stella. Then Mom spotted a shark off the port bow, a basking shark, she thought, which is also one of my favorite sharks. She said I had to write it down in my notebook anyway and then draw it. I looked them up. They're massive, but they don't eat people, just fish and plankton. I like doing my drawings. My best one so far is a flying fish. I sent a card to Eddie from Cape Verde Islands. I wish he could be here. We'd have a great time. Stella loves to chase a soccer ball around the cabin and pounce on it. She'll puncture it one day. I know she will. Dad's been a bit gloomy and Mom's gone to lie down. She's got a headache. I think they've had a bit of a tiff. Don't know what about exactly, but I think it's about chess. November 16th. We just left Recife. That's in Brazil. We were there 4 days. We had a lot of repairs to do on the boat. Something was wrong with the wind generator and the rudder cable's still sticking. I've played soccer in Brazil, if you can believe that. Did you hear that, Eddie? I've played soccer in Brazil and with your lucky ball. Dad and me were just kicking it around on the beach, and before we knew it, we had a dozen kids joining in. It was a proper game. Dad set it up. We picked sides. I called my side Mudlarks, and he called his Brazil. So they all wanted to play on his side, of course. But mom joined in on my side and we won. Mudlarks 5, Brazil 3. Mom invited them back for a Coke on board afterward. Stella growled at them and bared her teeth, so we had to shut her down in the cabin. They tried out their English on us. They only knew two words, goal and Manchester United. Well, that's three, I suppose. Mom had her film developed. There's a picture of some leaping dolphins, another of me on the winch. There's one of Mom at the wheel and another of Dad hauling down the mainsail and making a mess of it. There's one of me diving off a rock into the sea when we stopped in the Canaries. There's one of Dad fast asleep sunbathing on the deck and Mom giggling. She was about to dribble the sunblock all over his tummy. I took that one. It's my best photo. And then there's the one of me doing my math, sulking and sticking my tongue out. December 25th. Christmas Day at sea. Dad found some carols on the radio. We had crackers, all of them a bit soggy, so none of them cracked. And we had the Christmas pudding Grandma made for us. I gave them a drawing each. My flying fish for Dad, and one of the skipper in her hat at the wheel for Mom. They gave me a really cool knife they bought in Rio, so I gave a coin back. You're supposed to do that. It's for luck. When we were in Rio, we gave the Peggy Sue a good scrub down. She was looking a bit gross inside and outside, but she's not anymore. I suppose that's kind of like your house, too. If you don't vacuum and dust and everything, it can get a little gross. So you got to do it every once in a while. Good cleaning. We packed up a lot of supplies and water for the long haul to South Africa. Mom says we're doing fine just so long as we keep south, so long as we stay in the west to east South Atlantic current. We passed south of an island called St. Helena a few days ago. No need to stop. Nothing much there, except it's the place where Napoleon was exiled. He died there. Lonely place to die. So, of course, I had to do a history project on Napoleon. I had to look him up in the encyclopedia and write about him. It was quite interesting, really, but I didn't tell them that. Stella's sulking on my bunk. Maybe it's because no one gave her a Christmas present. I offered her a taste of Granny's Christmas pudding, but she hardly gave it a sniff. Can't say I blame her. I saw a sail today, another yacht. We shouted Merry Christmas and waved, and Stella barked her head off, but they were too far away. When the sail disappeared, the sea felt suddenly very empty. Mom won the chess game this evening. She's ahead now 21 games to 20. Dad said he let her win because it was Christmas. They joke about it, but they both want to win. January 1st. Africa again, Cape Town, Table Mountain. And this time we're not just sailing by. We're going to stop for a while. They told me this evening. They didn't want me to know before in case we couldn't afford it, but we can. We're going to stay for a couple of weeks, maybe more. We're going to see elephants and lions in the wild. I can't believe it. I don't think they can either. When they told me, they were like a couple of kids all laughing and happy. They were like, they're never like this at home. These days, they really smile at each other. My mom's getting stomach cramps. Dad wants her to see a doctor in Cape Town, but she won't. I reckon it's the baked beans. The good news is the baked beans have at last run out. The bad news is we had sardines for supper. Yuck. February 7th. We're hundreds of miles out in the Indian Ocean, and then this happens. Stella hardly ever comes up on deck unless it's flat calm. I don't know why she came up. I don't know why she was there. We were all busy, I suppose. Dad was down in the galley, and Mom was at the wheel. I was doing one of my navigation lessons, taking bearings with the sextant. The Peggy Sue was pitching and rolling a bit. I had to steady myself. I looked up and I saw Stella was at the bow of the boat. One moment she was just standing there. The next, she was gone. We had practiced the man overboard drill dozens of times back in the Solent with Barnacle Bill, shouting and pointing, keep shouting, keep pointing, turn into the wind, get the sails down quick, engine on. By the time Dad had the mainsail and the jib down, we were already heading back toward her. I was doing the pointing and the shouting too. She was paddling for her life in the green of a looming wave. Dad was leaning over the side and reaching for her, but didn't have his safety harness on, and Mom was going crazy. She was trying to bring the boat in as close and as slow as she could, but a wave took Stella away from us at the last moment. We had to turn and come back again. All the time I was pointing and shouting. 3 times we came in, but each time we passed her by, either we were going too fast or she was out of reach. She was weak by now. She was hardly paddling and she was going under. But only one last chance. We came in again perfectly this time and close enough for Dad to be able to reach out and grab her. Among the three of us, we managed to haul Stella back into the boat by her collar, by her tail. I got a well done monkey face from Dad, and Dad got a huge lecture from Mom for not wearing his safety harness. Dad just put his arms around her and she cried. Stella shook herself and went below as if nothing at all happened. Mom has made a strict rule because of this. Stella Artois is never to go out on deck, whatever the weather, without a safety harness clipped on like the rest of us. Dad's going to make one for her. I still dream of the elephants in South Africa. I loved how slow they are and thoughtful. I loved their wise, weepy eyes. I can still see those snooty giraffes looking down at me and the lion cub sleeping with his mother's tail in his mouth. I did lots of drawings and I keep looking at them to remind me. The sun in Africa is so big, so red. Australia's next. Kangaroos and possums and wombats. Uncle John's going to meet us in Perth. I've seen photos of him, but I've never met him. Dad said this evening he's only a distant uncle. Very distant, Mom had said, and they both laughed. I didn't get the joke till I thought about it again when I came on watch. The stars are so bright tonight, and Stella was saved. Thank goodness. I think I'm happier than I've ever been in my life. April 3rd. Off Perth, Australia. Until today, it has been nothing but empty ocean all the way from Africa. I love it more and more when it's just us and Peggy Sue in the sea. We all do, I think. But then when we sight land, we always get so excited. When we saw Australia for the first time, we hugged one another and jumped up and down. It's like we're the first sailors ever to discover it. Stella Artois barked at us as if we were crazy as loons, which we probably are. But we've done it. We've sailed all the way from England to Australia. That's halfway around the world, and we did it on our own. Mom's been getting her stomach cramps again. She's definitely going to see a doctor in Australia. She promised us, and we'll make her keep to it. May 28th, almost at the end of the chapter. At sea again after nearly 6 weeks with Uncle John, we thought we were going to stay in Perth for just a few days, but he said we had to see Australia properly while we were there. He took us to stay with his family on a huge farm, thousands and thousands of sheep. He's got tons of horses, so I went riding a lot with my two little cousins, Beth and Liza. They're only 7 and 8, but they could really ride. They called me Mikey. And by the time we left, they both wanted to marry me. Weirdos. We're going to be pen pals instead. I saw a snake called a copperhead. Uncle John said it could have killed me if I had stepped on it. He told me to watch out for redback spiders in the bathroom. I didn't go to the bathroom very often after that. They called us their pommy cousins, and we had barbecues every evening. We had a great time with them, but I was happy to get back to the Peggy Sue. I missed her while I was gone, like I miss Eddie. I've been sending him cards, funny animal cards if I find them. I sent him one of a wombat. Saw a wombat too, for real, and hundreds of possums and tons of kangaroos, and they've got white cockatoos in Australia like you've got, we've got sparrows back home, millions of them. But out here, it's gulls again. Wherever we've been in the world, there's always gulls. The plan is we're going to stop in Sydney, explore the Great Barrier Reef for a bit, then go through the Coral Sea and up toward Papua New Guinea. Mom's stomach cramps are much better. The doctor in Australia said that it was probably something she'd eaten. Anyway, she's better now. It's really hot and heavy. It's calm, too. There's no wind. We're hardly moving. I can't see any clouds, but I'm sure a storm is coming. I can feel it. July 28th. I look around me. It's a dark, dark night. No moon, no stars, but it's calm again, at last. I'll be 12 tomorrow. Now, that should be an important thing for you if you're thinking about this, because the very first line of the book, remember, I told you it was my favorite. The very first line of the book was, I disappeared on the night before my 12th birthday. His birthday is July 28th. And this entry that is in here is July 28th. So it's the night before his 12th birthday. It should send goose bumps on your arms. All right, back to this. It's calm again at last. I'll be 12 tomorrow, but I don't think anyone except me will remember it. We've had a terrible time, far worse even than in the Bay of Biscay. Ever since we left Sydney, it's been just storm after storm, and each one blows us farther north across the Coral Sea. The rudder cable has snapped. Dad's done what he can, but it's still not right. The self-steering doesn't work anymore, so someone's got to be at the wheel all the time. And that means Dad or me, because Mom is sick. It's her stomach cramps again, but they're a lot worse. She doesn't want to eat at all. All she has is sugared water. She hasn't been able to look at the charts for 3 days. Dad wants to put out a Mayday call, but Mom won't let him. She says that's giving in, and she's never giving in. Dad and I have been doing the navigation together. We've been doing our best, but I don't think we know where we are anymore. They're both asleep down below. Dad's really wiped out. I'm at the wheel in the cockpit. I've got Eddie's soccer ball with me. It's been lucky for us so far. And now we really need it. We need Mom to get better, or we're in real trouble. I don't know if we could stand another storm. Thank God it's calm. It'll help Mom sleep. You can't sleep when you're being slammed about all the time. It is so dark out here, black. Stella's barking. She's up by the bow. She hasn't got her harness clip on. And those were the last words I ever wrote in my log. After that, it's just empty pages. I tried calling Stella first, but she wouldn't come. So I left the wheel and went forward to bring her back. I took the ball with me to, you know, sweeten her in, to tempt her away from the bow of the boat. I crouched down. Come on, Stella, I said, rolling the ball between my hands. Come and get the ball. I felt the boat turn a little in the wind, and I knew then I shouldn't have left the wheel. The ball rolled away from me quite suddenly. I lunged after it, but it was gone over the side before I could grab it. I lay there on the deck, watching it bob away into the darkness. I was furious with myself for being so stupid. I was still cursing myself when I thought I heard the sound of singing. Someone was singing out there in the darkness. I called out, but no one replied. So that was what Stella had been barking at. I looked again for my ball, but by now it had disappeared. That ball had been very precious to me and precious to all of us. I knew then I had just lost a great deal more than a soccer ball. I was angry with Stella. The whole thing had been her fault. She was still barking and I couldn't hear the singing anymore. I called her again, whistled her in, and she wouldn't come. I got to my feet and went forward. I took her by the collar and pulled. She would not be moved. Couldn't drag her all the way back, so I bent down to pick her up. She was still reluctant, and then I had her in my arms, but she was struggling. I heard the wind above me in the sails. I remember thinking, this is silly. You haven't got your safety harness on. You haven't got your life jacket on. You shouldn't be doing this. And then the boat veered violently and I was thrown sideways. With my arms full, I had no time to grab the guardrail. We were in the cold of the sea before I could even open my mouth to scream. And I'll stop there. So that's the first three chapters. And now you know Michael falls off the ship. But I want you to think to yourself, where are mom and dad? And does anyone know that he's fallen off of the ship? And how long will it take for people to notice that? And in the meantime, when all this is happening, the boat is moving away from Michael. And Michael's in the water without his life jacket. And he also has Stella with him. Next chapter is called Gibbons and Ghosts. And so I'll send out another link that has this and I'll read as well. But 45 minutes of listening to me is probably enough. But so I'll be back to read chapters 4 and on another link. All right. I hope you're still interested.